Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about dung beetles with Doug Emlin, a professor of biology at the University of Montana and an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre and extreme shapes in insects. While he initially resisted the idea of studying dung beetles, a failure in his dissertation fieldwork forced him to change his tune, and he's glad he did. Now he's a dung beetle aficionado, and you may be too after listening to the fascinating life of this strange group of creatures. Dung beetles live all over the world, on every continent except Antarctica. They thrive in virtually every type of habitat, from deserts to rainforests. As their name suggests, their main food source is dung, making them a key part of nature's cleanup crew. By eating and burying the undigested bits of food that pass through herbivores and other animals, dung beetles recycle nutrients back into the soil and eliminate a magnet for pests such as flies. As you'll hear, dung beetles are an unparalleled sewage SWAT team. In parts of Texas, for example, dung beetles can bury 80% of the cattle dung. They work quickly, too. Researchers have found that a horde of about 16,000 beetles will find and dispose of an elephant's 1.5-kilogram dung pat in just 2 hours. If they didn't, the landscape would be a mess. Did you know that a single cow patty will attract 3,000 flies within 2 weeks? With each cow producing a dozen pats each day, it wouldn't be long before a pasture would become incredibly smelly and fly-infested without these workhorses. You're probably already familiar with dung beetles. In fact, dung beetles were also known as scarabs and were revered by ancient Egyptians. You'll find these scarab images in ancient Egyptian religious and funerary art as a symbol of transformation, renewal, and resurrection. Dung beetles are really small, ranging from less than 2 millimeters, that's about 0.1 inches, to 6 centimeters, about 2.5 inches. But they're surprisingly strong. They're stout weightlifters, able to roll over 50 times or more of their weight. Some species can even pull over 1,000 times its own body weight. That's like a 180-pound man pulling over 200,000 pounds. Dr. Doug Emlin was always interested in animal armament and became even more interested after studying a species of dung beetle in Panama that specialized in howler monkey scat. Since then, he broadened his research to dung beetles all over the world and has noticed interesting patterns in their weaponry. Now he's focusing his research on the evolutionary forces that make animal weapons, like dung beetle horns, elk antlers, and rhino horns, so diverse. When I spoke to Doug, I asked him how he first got interested in this amazing insect.
Well, I actually started out avoiding the dung beetles. I didn't want to work on the dung beetles.
Oh, really?
Perhaps a little squeamish, or I just thought, I guess I thought, what kind of person grows up and works on dung beetles for a living?
And what kind does?
Well, apparently me, but it took a while to get there. So, no, my wife right now was very angry at me early on, because when I met her first, she was doing field work at the Rocky Mountain Lab in Colorado, and I came out and I met her, and I kept saying, oh, I work on beetles, and I wouldn't tell her that they were dung beetles, and I think we'd been dating for almost a month before she found out from somebody else that it was actually dung beetles that I was going to Panama to study. And she's a biologist, so she was really mad at me for being ashamed to tell her, but I didn't want her to think I was some kind of weirdo. But no, I was interested in insects. And I knew I wanted to work on insects with really funky morphologies, things like weapons or exaggerated traits. And I fell in love with the beetles pretty quickly as a group with sort of spectacular armaments and all kinds of diversity in morphology. And some of the champions of the beetles with horns are dung beetles. Now, I really truly started out avoiding the dung beetles. I mean, I didn't even read the dung beetle papers. I was reading about rhinoceros beetles and Hercules beetles and all these other types of beetles. And started out as a graduate student basically putting together a project to go to Ecuador and study a rhinoceros beetle, which is not a dung beetle, and spent all my savings to go down there for 4 months, spent a month learning Spanish with an intensive crash course, and then spent the rest of the time searching for beetles. And I failed. I mean, I couldn't find them. they were too difficult to find in any type of consistent numbers. I backpacked all over Ecuador and ended up in these little tiny villages and walking around showing pictures of these beetles to the local kids and trying to figure out where I could find populations of these things. And basically at the end of that field season, it was a wash. I'd hardly found any animals.
Oh, really? Why was that?
Well, it turns out that even though the species I was looking for was technically abundant, and according to all the collections and all the journal, you know, what literature there was, they are super abundant relative to some of the other beetles. They actually only are abundant for a very, very narrow window of time. They come out when the big rains hit, and they come flooding out, and they're out basically for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they all disappear again.
Oh, really?
And here I was down there, the rains didn't come. They were late. And so, I waited, and then finally after I gave up and I got back to grad school at Princeton, somebody sent me this squashed beetle in a paper, you know, basically in a cardboard envelope and said, hey, is this what you were looking for? They're everywhere. They're sweeping them off the streets and people are turning their windshield wipers on to get them off the cars. And I just had missed it. The rains had come late and I'd spent all my money and done my whole field season and I'd missed it. But the hidden message there is that wasn't going to be tractable for studying. You can't do a dissertation on a project that's that hard to find and that's only out for a really brief window of time. And so I had to go back to the drawing board. And it was Bill Eberhard. It was a naturalist, a biologist who was an expert on insect behavior and insect morphology that steered me towards the dung beetles. So,
and what did he say that finally got you over your squeamishness, aside from maybe all that failure of the other ones?
So I've told this story before, but basically what happened is I had corresponded with him beforehand. This is Bill Eberhard, and he was the person who had done the best studies I'd seen on any of the horned beetles before. And so I was sort of in awe of his work. And I'd written to him, and he'd been very friendly and helpful and written me long letters back with all kinds of constructive suggestions. And so
And where was he at the time?
Oh, he works at the Universidad de Costa Rica. So he lives... He basically lives in Costa Rica, and so I'd never met him at that time. But when everything failed in Ecuador, I basically asked if I could go visit him on my way back. And so on my way back to graduate school, I stopped off and spent a day or two in Costa Rica visiting Bill Eberhard. And he sort of took me under his wing, and he pulled out these boxes of beetles, and he said, "Oh, you're looking at the wrong insects. I mean, no wonder you didn't find what you were looking for. You can't study those big rhinoceros beetles. Look at these." And he pulled out this box, and it was full of these little tiny, tiny dung beetles. And I just remember him opening the box, and I remember it stunk, too. I mean, it smelled like dung beetles. And I looked at him, and I just had this look on my face. I said, "Those are dung beetles. No way." And he read me the riot act. He explained that I was a fool. I mean, he actually called me a fool. He said, "These things are actually abundant all the time, not just for 3 weeks or so a year. They live in all kinds of different habitats. They have weapons, which is what I wanted to study, that are every bit as spectacular as the rhino beetles. It's just relative to their size, so you have to look a little closer to see them. But they're amazing weapons, and they're really diverse across species. They had dimorphism, which meant that the big males had weapons and the small males didn't. So they had that potential for looking at the behavior associated with these two types of males. And you could rear them in captivity, which was another crucial piece to the story. If I wanted to do any kind of genetic work on these things, I'd have to be able to breed them. And the rhinoceros beetles take 1 or 2 years, sometimes 3 years to grow. These guys, you can rear in a month in a flower pot. So every single criterion I would want for a system to study, these things had. But I still was too squeamish. I said, "I'm not going to go through life studying dung beetles. I won't do it." And so I went back to Princeton and my doctoral committee sat me down and said, "Look, your field season was a disaster. You need to start over. We don't want you to continue working on the rhinoceros beetles. Start from scratch." And they said, "Make a list. Figure out what you want to do. Figure out what the species you want to work on needs to have if you're going to do it, and come back to us." And I sat down and I made my list, and by gosh, Bill Eberhard was right. Everything I wanted to do, the dung beetles had. So I switched. I had to call him back and sort of apologize and say, "I changed my mind. Can I work on the dung beetles now?"
And did he, what was his reaction at that point?
He's been great over the years. Yeah, I think he probably just laughed at me. But it was a good change. I've learned a tremendous amount from the dung beetles.
And what made the switch from being, you know, too ashamed to tell your girlfriend slash wife to now being like this advocate, dung beetle advocate.
See that strategy work, though. I'm married to her, right?
Right.
I think I had to get over first impressions. The first impression you get of these things is anything that eats manure has got to be disgusting. And any person that goes around poking around in manure has got to be a fool. But that's not true. Ask any rancher or farmer. They spend their lives up to their elbows in manure. It's an amazing fertilizer, and people use it all the time. It's not actually anywhere near as disgusting to work with as lots of other things. In fact, I think Drosophila medium, the things that so many geneticists use, is way more foul-smelling than horse manure. And so it really isn't that bad, first of all. And then second of all, the animals are phenomenal. I mean, the more you learn about them, the more blown away you get. So once you get past that first reaction and you start looking a little bit deeper, and the way I guess I like to tell it now is once you teach people to get on their hands and knees and actually look at these things and pick them up and hold them in their hands, there's no going back. I mean, you see how cool these things are, and that's it. Your opinion is forever changed.
So tell me about dung beetles. What are they for someone who's never heard of them? What are dung beetles and what's interesting about them?
Well, technically they are a group of scarab beetles in the subfamily Scarabaeinae, and the entire group of these beetles feeds on dung in one way or another, although there's a few derived species that have branched out into fungi and other kinds of crazy things, but most of them, let's say, feed on dung. They tend to feed on dung both as adult beetles, but also in particular as larvae. So all of the dung beetles have a way of providing their young, their larvae, with access to dung, which is the food source that they feed on and they grow. From an insect's perspective, dung is actually a really nutritious food source. Compared to plant leaf material or fluids that they would suck out of plants or lots of the other things, fungi, that insects would feed on, dung is really nutrient-rich. And in particular, it's rich in nitrogen, which is what immature animals need to grow. You need nitrogen to build proteins, and you need proteins in order to build tissues, and so growing animals need nitrogen, and dung is a far better source of that than just about anything else that insects would feed on, except maybe carrion. So it's a great resource for the animals. The dung beetles are this one group of animals that have specialized on it, and they have diversified spectacularly to colonize and to feed on pretty much any type of dung you can imagine. And so one of the things that's neat about dung beetles is their diversity. You can find generalist dung beetles that'll feed on pretty much anything that falls in a pasture, and you can find exquisite degrees of specialization. You can find dung beetles that are only ever found in pack rat burrows feeding on the dung of pack rats, or in marmot burrows, or you can find dung beetles that cling to the fur of sloths and ride around on the backs of the sloths and feed on sloth dung when they go to the bathroom. Or you can find independent parallel lineages of dung beetles that do the same thing on koalas and ride around in the fur of koalas in Australia and feed on koala dung. So there are dung beetles specialized for just about any type of dung you can imagine. And it's one of the reasons there's so many species of dung beetles. It's a very speciose group of insects. The genus that I work on the most, a genus called Onthophagus, has 2,000 species already described by taxonomists, and they estimate there's another 1,000 species waiting to be described, which places it, as far as I can tell, as the largest single genus of anything anywhere, period. So one thing that's interesting about dung beetles is their diversity, the numbers of different species that have radiated out from this one group of insects. And the other thing that I'm excited by is their mating system, the fact that males compete with each other over access to females, and this has generated very strong selection for weapons. So analogous to antlers in deer or elk or moose, the beetles have male horns, and the horns are curved and straight and branched and forked, and they come from the front of the head and the middle of the head and the back of the head and the thorax. There are so many kinds of horns coming off of these beetles that it blows the mind. So that's what I've spent years studying the horns. My personal obsession is with the weapons because I'm interested in how animals could produce such extreme morphological structures. So we do everything from looking at the behaviors of the animals using the horns to the development of the horns to actually the genes that are involved with the growth and the shaping, the patterning of the horns. So we really are interested in the weapons. But there's so much more that dung beetles offer to other biologists around the world. They have elaborate forms of parental care. So extended investment of time and energy and effort on the part of the parents taking care of the young. And in many species, it involves the males too. So there's biparental care of the offspring. And they have whole sort of sexually selected mating system battlegrounds that take place that don't even involve the weapons, but involve the sperm. And so when females mate with multiple males, the sperm from the different males have to compete inside the reproductive tracts of the females. And dung beetles are turning out to be a really neat system where people are starting to study that development of sexual selection and animal behavior. So they actually offer an awful lot. But again, my focus has been the weapons.
And then in the ecosystem, what is the role that they play? You know,
How could I forget that?
You know, and would we miss them if they were gone?
I think the safe answer to that one is yes. We would miss them quite a lot. For the simple reason that there's a lot of animals, particularly large ruminant herbivores, that are producing copious quantities of dung, and it would pile up. And in fact, historically, it did pile up. The best story I can give on this one took place in Australia a number of years ago, but when they cleared back forests and created pasture land for cattle, it just so happened historically that the native dung beetles in Australia were all forest specialist species, and none of them would go out into the open. They couldn't handle the dry, open habitats of pastures. They weren't acclimated or adapted to those types of environments. And so you had all these pasture lands with no dung beetles, and you had all these cattle populations in the pastures producing manure with no dung beetles. And there are photographs that are pretty frightening of essentially cow pie to cow pie as far as you can see. I mean, these fields just got smothered in manure. And there was nothing in the ecosystem burying that or taking those nutrients and getting it off the surface and down into the soil. And so not only was it really detrimental to the forage, to the grasses and things in the ecosystems, because they were literally covered with manure, but they had pest fly populations that started to explode. So there are flies that also feed on manure, and these things were out there in incredible numbers and driving everybody crazy. So there was a dung beetle biologist I met when I was down there a few years ago that had a picture of his daughter sunbathing in the backyard, and she had like 1,000 flies all over her body. So the fly densities got really bad, and Australia realized they had to do something to get rid of the manure. And so the CSIRO, the equivalent of the U.S. Department of Agriculture here, went to great lengths to find sort of ecologically sustainable species of dung beetles that they could pull from Europe or Africa and introduce into Australia to get rid of the problem. And so we actually know from human history what happens when you remove the dung beetles, and it's not pretty.
And when was that? That was happening? Or when was these other dung beetles introduced in Australia?
My recollection is that it was in the late 60s and early 70s is when they went actively into the process of mass rearing and releasing these beetles. And they've now been established in lots of parts of Australia for the last 30, 40 years.
Do you happen to know if there's any negative impact from that introduction?
I'm sure there must be some, but I'd have to say compared to other types of biological introductions that I'm familiar with, this is the best success story I can think of. And the reason I think it was a success story is that they actually paid attention to the biology of the animals. They didn't just quick and dirty go grab some beetles and throw them in the ecosystem. They did their homework. And what they figured out is that the species in Australia were all forest specialists, and none of them would cross that barrier into the pastures. And so what they then did is they went to Africa and to Europe, and they said, well, let's find pasture specialists that won't cross into the forests. And so they did all these trapping grid tests. So they would try to find species they could find in the open, but then they would also set traps up in the woods. And if they ever caught them in the woods, they'd reject that species as something that wasn't going to stay strictly in the pastures. But they were able to find the inverse, essentially pasture specialists So species that were reluctant to go into the shaded, more humid understories of forests, and these were the species they focused on. And they went through all kinds of quarantine procedures, and I mean, I think they treated all the eggs with formaldehyde and all kinds of crazy things to make sure that they didn't introduce any pathogens or soil microbes that would have been detrimental. And they brought these things in and reared them in captivity until they had huge numbers and released them. And as far as I know, it's worked. Which that means is they've been able to establish a non-native dung beetle in the pastures, but the non-native species have not had a detrimental impact on the native species because they haven't crossed that barrier and they haven't moved into the forests. Some of the native species are in trouble, but it's not because of the new beetle. It's because of habitat destruction and just the fact that there's not as much forest as there used to be. But the species that they introduced, as far as I know, worked. They did the job that was asked of them, and they did not detrimentally impact the native dung beetle species.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
So you said there are well more than 2,000 different species of...
In the genus I work on, there's probably more like 10,000 species of dung beetles all told.
Oh, really? And what is unique about the genus that you're working on? What is the name of the genus again?
Depending on who you talk to, it's either Onthophagus or Onthophagus. And what's unique about them is, first of all, that genus is the most diverse. So something special is happening in that particular genus of beetles. And the other thing that I can't say unique, because other dung beetles have weapons too, but one of the things that's noteworthy about them is how many of the species have these really cool horns. And lots and lots and lots of them do. There are species with female horns. There are species where both the males and the females have horns. And when you reconstruct the history, so this is one of the things that we did a few years ago, was to sample species from around the world and collect DNA from their tissues and essentially grind it up and sequence the DNA and then use the genomes or the DNA from these things to reconstruct a phylogeny. So we were building a tree that reflects our best guess of the history of these beetles. So which species branched off from which others and when. And it lets us come up with a branching pattern that's a visual representation of the history of the lineage splitting as these species diversified and broke off from each other and formed new species. But once we had this tree...
So it's sort of like it's sort of like a family tree.
A family tree is a good analogy, yes. It traces back in time the relatedness among the different groups of beetles so that we can figure out which species today seem to be most like the early ancestors. We can use the DNA of these things to reconstruct the past. And the idea there is that species that are very close to each other, that are, say, sister species and shared a common ancestor very recently, are also going to have very similar sequences in their DNA. But the more divergent these lineages are, and the longer they've been separate from each other, the more their DNA has been accumulating changes and mutations independently, and the more differences we expect to see in their DNA. And so what you can do then is use the similarities of the sequences of the DNA in these big, fun, complex algorithms on a computer to sort them out so that the species that are the most closely related to each other group together. And the lineages or the species that are the most distantly related to each other end up falling out as much more separate. And when you do that, you come up with a tree, a branching pattern that traces from a trunk, which would be the sort of common ancestor of all of the beetles, and then reconstructs over time how those lineages of beetles, we think, diverged from each other. So groups will split off and then begin to evolve independently, and then those groups will split amongst themselves, and then those groups will split amongst themselves. And we can reconstruct that relationship amongst these species. We call it a phylogeny.
What do you do with that phylogeny?
Once we have that branching pattern, we have a working hypothesis for the history of that group. We know which species broke off from which others, and we know roughly when that occurred. We can then trace the evolution of specific traits, like horns. We can use that phylogeny to say, well, what do we think the earliest beetles in this group looked like? And what's our best guess for what the horns, the weapons on these things would have looked like back then? And then how did those horns change over time as all of these beetles diversified and became specialized for their different foods and broke off from each other? And so we can trace through time how this character, the horns, changed.
And what happens when you do that?
When you do that, you find it's really surprising. They changed a lot. If these things were very... If they didn't change very fast, then what you'd expect is all the beetles that are close to each other in that tree would all have the same type of horns. And all the beetles maybe on the other half of the tree would have maybe a different kind of horn. But there'd be just a couple types of horns, and they'd be very tightly clustered so that all the things that are related to each other look the same. And that's not what we find. We find that horns were gained and lost and gained and lost and gained and lost again and again and again and again. And they've changed in all kinds of crazy directions, so that even very close relatives, sister species that have been, I mean, only sort of split off from each other very recently, can have totally different horn morphologies. And when you look at how the horns have changed over the history of the beetles, it's a mess. They've gone all over the place. And to a biologist like me, that's amazing. That tells us that something special is happening with these horns. And they're evolving or changing much faster than all the rest of the beetles. And that's a lot of the story that we've been trying to figure out, is what's going on with these weapons, and how is it that they can change so fast when the rest of the beetles look pretty much the same?
That's really interesting. Can you describe some of these sort of sister relatives that have such different horn morphologies and what the horns look like? You had mentioned that some of these horns grow out of the thorax and the back of the head and the front of the head. And
yes. Well, first of all, I should start by describing the beetle. The beetles themselves are very stout. They're sort of robust little beetles. And if you compare them to other... So if you're crazy enough to do what I do, and you go out into a field and you pull over basically a piece of horse manure, and you look at the ground and you pull out the beetles, and especially if you do this in the tropics or in Africa, in a habitat where there's tons and tons and tons of species there, what you'll find is there's all these beetles run away from you in all these different directions. And some of them are really shiny and smooth and they run really fast. And some of them are long and thin and weave in and out of things. The staphylinid beetles are very sleek and I mean, they look almost like little earwigs as they twist around. The genus that I work on stands out because they're like little squat tortoises. They're very stout, round beetles, and they waddle in a very deliberate, sort of an awkward way. And once you know that look, and I've seen this now, we've looked for these beetles on essentially five continents and I think something like 15 different countries. And once you know the look, it doesn't matter what species you're dealing with out of that 2,000, you can spot them in a heartbeat. They really are these sort of squat, taut beetles that waddle in this very characteristic, awkward style that makes me think of little turtles walking around under the manure.
How big are they?
Often they're tiny. So a lot of the species we work on, the analogy I like to use is they're the size of an eraser on a brand new pencil. If you took a razor blade and cut the eraser off a new pencil, that's about the shape and size of a lot of the species. In some environments, some habitats, they get quite a bit bigger. So you could be dealing with ones that are the size of, say, a marble. But most of them are pretty small. But so you've got this turtle-like morphology of this tiny little beetle. But when you start to look closer, that's when you start to see the horns. And the horns can be pretty impressive. They can be huge. So again, the analogy I like to use is that some of these horns are easily 15%, 20%, 25% of the body weight of the animals. That's not trivial. That truly, if you do the math, is equivalent to a human being, you, producing another leg and wearing it around on your head for your entire adult lifetime. That's about how much weight and mass were, you know, sort of material stuff that we're talking about, that these beetles are allocating to the horns.
Wow.
So
and just by
not trivial structures.
And just by comparison, say a moose or an elk, how much of their body weight is in the...
I'm going to guess, and I'm going to get in trouble here, but I'm going to guess that even the best bull elk would have a rack that is probably less than 5% of its body weight. So in terms of bulk, the beetle horns are bigger. In terms of length, not necessarily. Some of the full 6 and 7 point bull elk, for example, have antlers that are probably almost as long as the rest of the male's body. And that is on par with these beetles. The horn lengths would be about the same. But in terms of the proportion of their body mass, the beetles take the cake. They win.
Really?
Yeah. Now, there's a few extinct things. So there's the Gaelic moose and the Irish elk that had some really spectacular weapons. And those things might stand up to these beetles.
And in terms of compared to other insects, say the rhinoceros beetle that you were going to look at first, is that...
The rhinoceros beetles are up there too. They're just as impressive. And we actually work on a rhinoceros beetle in my lab now, finally, after all these years. And I love them. So I'm not going to be dissing the rhinoceros beetles here.
So tell
me. In terms of other insects, there are a number of insects that produce very large exaggerated structures. And that's truly my obsession in my career, is to study the development and the evolution of these extreme structures in animals. And insects, that they're champions of this. There are giraffe weevils, for example, in New Zealand that have their whole neck and head are on these stalks that, I mean, they look like they should just tip over. The stalk is longer than the whole rest of the body. And there's stalk-eyed flies that have their eyes on eye stalks, and the width of these eye stalks is wider than the whole rest of the fly is long. So there are membracids, these little tree hopper insects that have huge growths that come off of their backs, their pronotum, that can be just, I mean, stunning compared to the size of these insects. So insects have a lot of diversity that way. And I shouldn't just give credit to the insects. The champions, as far as I know, in terms of weapon sizes, are actually a crab.
What kind of crabs?
It's the fiddler crabs.
There are some species
of fiddler crabs where the males will have a chela or a claw that's 50% of their body weight. And that's amazing. No matter how you look at it, that's amazing. But the dung beetles come pretty darn close, and I think they stand their ground against the elk and the moose and the sort of charismatic megafauna that people think of, caribou, when they think of weapons.
So tell me what they look like.
Well, so there are species that have on their heads a single horn, like a unicorn, that comes up and wraps all the way over their backs. And in some of these cases, the horns, they look like little toothpicks curling up over the backs of their heads. The horn is actually almost twice as long as the rest of the beetle. So it extends a full body length beyond the beetle behind it.
Really?
And,
so
yes.
How can it maneuver around or walk?
That's a good question. they're not very agile animals. As I said, they walk like tortoises.
So they're not the most athletic of beetles.
Well, it depends on how you define athleticism. They are athletic in the sense that a weightlifter is athletic, because they're very strong for their body size, but they're not agile or fast.
What's your favorite?
My favorite of all is an East African species. It's a brilliant iridescent green, so it's a metallic green to blue green to purple, even green, depending on the light. And they have a pair of horns. So. Two horns the way most of the African antelope or the deer would have, and they come up and they curl around the body, and then they have a tine coming off of them, so they fork just like deer antlers would fork. And then when they get all the way out to the tips broaden into these palmate sort of extensions that are much more like would occur in the horns of the antlers of a caribou or a moose. So it's this curved, branched set of horns that flattens out into these triangular tips at the end. And they also are extremely long. So they wrap all the way around the animal, and they extend the full length of that male all the way to the back. So a huge rack on these things. But then there's other species. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so what's the purpose of that shape?
You're not allowed to ask that. Because after all these years, I still don't have a good answer. Not for a lack of trying. Let me describe a few more of the shapes, and then I'll come back to that.
Okay.
That question is the thorn in my side, but it's okay. That's what keeps science fun. It keeps us humble. So there's another species, the one that I'm actually going with my kids to Hawaii to collect next week, is a species that actually is African, but it's been introduced into Hawaii, which makes it easier for us to collect them. And it has a horn that comes from the thorax, which in an insect is sort of the equivalent, if you picture yourself like a dung beetle, like that tortoise-shaped beetle, the thorax is the shoulder blades right behind your head. And the horn comes from between those shoulder blades, and it extends over your head, and it's a long curved horn, again like a toothpick, that extends in front of the beetle. And in this case, these horns can be longer than the rest of the beetle, so it's like having a jousting javelin or spear in front of your body all the time.
Are there others like that?
There's other beetles that have, coming from the shoulder blades again, from the thorax, they have a big wide shelf. So it's like a big, I'm trying to think of the analogy, it's like a huge board coming forward over their heads. And then it ends at the end by splitting into a series of branches or tines. but it's really like a wide shelf.
Are there other strange forms?
There are species that have horns that are like tusks that come off of the front of the head. They look sort of like the tusks you'd have on a wild boar. And there are species that have a horn that looks like a spatula. It comes right from the front of the faceplate or the lip at the front of the head. And it, I mean, honestly, it's like a curved spatula that you'd use. You wouldn't use it for pancakes because it curls around, but it's the shape of a big triangular spatula, and it sticks in front of the face of these things. So all kinds of variation in the shapes of the horns.
Why all these different shapes?
Well, there's some things that we can answer, and there's some things that we can't. One thing that we're fairly confident about is that the horns, we think we understand why the horns are big.
Why is that?
What happens in this case is that in most of these beetles, the mating system, the way it works, is that the females will find the dung and they'll dig a tunnel into the ground underneath the dung. And this is a species with parental care. So what happens then is once they've dug the tunnel, the female will spend usually several days pulling pieces of dung down into the ends of the tunnel and packing it into these sausage-type brood masses or brood balls, as we like to call them. And inside each of these brood balls, once she's made it, she'll hollow out a chamber at the end and make a little tiny stalk and then lay an egg on the stalk. So the egg is in this airtight little chamber, not touching the sides of anything. It's sort of sticking out into space in this little chamber on the end of this brood ball. And then once the egg hatches, the larva lives inside that sausage-like brood mass, and it eats it completely as it develops. And it does its entire developmental period on that amount of food that the female has stored underground. And then when it's done development, it'll crawl to the surface and repeat the cycle. Well, so a female can spend a lot of days pulling hundreds of trips of dung into the tunnel and making these different brood balls. And she'll make one, and then she'll fill the tunnel in behind her, and then she'll make another, and then she'll fill the tunnel in behind that and make another. And as this type of provisioning behavior is going on, a male will try to guard that tunnel and keep everybody else away. And he'll mate with the female as often as he possibly can. Every time she comes up to the top to try to get dung, he'll try to mate with her. He'll often try to keep her in the tunnel. And this is one of the ways that you get biparental care in this system, is the males will go out into the dung and pull fragments of it back and cram it into the tunnel. Just, it appears at least, to keep the females from having to go out and do that herself. That way the male can keep the female in the tunnel. And so the males will actually help provision the tunnels, and then the females will take the dung from the top of the tunnel all the way to the ends of the tunnel and actually make the brood balls. So the males are guarding the tunnels. You've got a tortoise-shaped beetle guarding a cylindrical tunnel, and the job of that male is to keep any and all other males out. And that's where the horns come in. And they use the horns in these fights. So rival males will challenge these males and try to get past them into the tunnel, and that's where the fights will take place. And so these beetles fight surprisingly viciously. They're really fun fights to watch.
Can inside you describe tunnels. One of these fights? I mean, it sounds like, you know, the Gladiator or Robin Hood, you know.
Except they're not quite as agile, remember. The Gladiator with turtles. They're not the most impressive things to watch because you're looking at two eraser-sized black animals in the dirt in the dark. But the fights are pretty interesting. The best descriptor I can use is chaos. I expected, again, based on some of the studies that Bill Everhart had done on other beetles, that there would be a very ritualized type of a contest, and that the males would sort of lock together like a lock and a key, and the two opponents would fit together in a very precise fashion, and then they would push and push and push, and it would be a strength contest. And there are some beetles that do that, but these guys don't seem to. Instead, it's pandemonium. They push and they pry and they twist and they try to dig past each other, and the other ones are prodding and prying with their horns and they scramble. And sometimes, I mean, these beetles are so awkward in these tunnels that they can't even turn around. A big male can't even turn around. And so sometimes he'll, like, if he's facing down the tunnel and another male comes up and bumps into him from behind, he can't even turn around to engage that male. What he has to do is back out of the tunnel, forcing the other male with him until he gets to the surface. Then he can turn around and back into the tunnel, and then they can actually fight proper. And so they twist and they pry, and they sometimes can push the sides of the tunnel so far apart that they will turn around or twist.
So what does the fighting style mean for the horn shapes?
We filmed lots of these fights, expecting to find all kinds of magical clues to why you'd have a twisted horn or a straight horn or a horn with branches or a spatula horn on the front of your face. And we've come up empty. What I can tell you from lots of observations is that somehow at the end of the day, the male with the bigger horns usually wins.
So size does matter.
Size does matter. Body size really matters. The bigger beetle always wins to a close approximation. But once you control for size, if you have two beetles that are about the same size, then weapons matter, and the male with the bigger weapons wins. So there's been a number of studies by myself, by Armin Mochik, by Lee Simmons and John Hunt. A number of people have done this in different systems, and we've all found the same things, that the bighorns really do matter, and they help the males win. So what we have is a system where there's what we would call it directional sexual selection for weapon sizes that are big. And if your weapons are bigger than everybody else's, then you've got an edge. And you can win these contests over the tunnels, and if you can keep everybody else at bay, you can mate with the female, and there's presumably a reproductive advantage. The problem is we can't explain why one horn shape works better than another. We've had trouble with that step. If they lock together in that lock and key fashion, then you can envision how a horn shape would matter a lot, because it has to fit precisely into the grooves or the notches on the opponent male. But these things don't do that. They push and they twist and they bump into each other and they pry. There's no consistent sort of fitting of a weapon into a groove or a slot on the other individual. And so there's no obvious use of a particular shape. As near as I can tell, what they are is like bars on a jail cell. They just help anchor the beetle into the tunnel and make it more difficult for the other beetle to push past. And pretty much anything that blocks that tunnel or that can be stuck into the sides of the tunnel helps. And for all of these things, bigger weapons seem to work better than smaller weapons. But why one species has a triangle and another species has a branched horn, we don't know yet.
And then do you ever find one species fighting with another? I mean, do they cross mates?
That's a great question. Not as often as we'd like. And that's one of the reasons we haven't been able to do very well at resolving this question of why the horns differ in shape, is that we can't just pick a species with a thorax horn and a species with a head horn and get them to fight with the same type of intensity that we can with two individuals of the same species. So the horns are really variable, but the shape variation occurs among species. And so we don't have a species that has both a long javelin coming from their shoulder blades and a pair or other individuals that have a pair of horns coming from the head. Those kinds of differences we get by looking across species. And so we haven't been able to stage it that way. And we've tried gluing horns on these things so that we can conjugate it with a different kind of horn. We probably will be able to do that with the rhinoceros beetles because they're very big. But these little dung beetles, we've tried dental glues and super glues, and we have not been able to engineer or manufacture a biologically plausible version of a dung beetle with the wrong type of horns yet. So the answer is no, we don't get the different species fighting with each other as much as we would like. And because of that, we haven't been able to see the circumstances under which a thorax horn would win over a head horn or a curved horn would win over a straight horn, for example.
I'm going to get back to the research side. But before that, in thinking about the horns and wondering just about other adaptations that they have, it seems that they spend most of their life underground. Is that right? Half and half?
They spend a lot of their life underground. So first of all, as a larva, so their whole developmental period is spent underground. Then they come above ground and they have to disperse. These things can fly. These are flying turtles with horns.
Okay. You forgot to mention that part.
They definitely can fly. These aren't swallows or really agile birds here, but they can fly. And they need to fly. It's essential because dung isn't a resource. Except in Australia, after decades of no dung beetles, dung isn't a resource that is everywhere. You have to find it. It's a patchy, unpredictable resource. It appears suddenly on the landscape over here, and then it might appear suddenly on the landscape next week over there. The beetles have to find it. So they're very good at detecting smell, and they're able to use the odor cues to find the food sources, and they can find them really fast.
Like how fast?
In the tropics, the dung beetles, where I was studying them, that fed on howler monkey dung, could find the monkey dung within 15, 20, 30 seconds after the dung appeared on the ground. You'd already have the first beetles coming in. And so they're very good at finding this food source because they have to compete with all these other animals to get to it. And so they do fly. They're above ground for that time period. But once they find food, they burrow into the ground underneath, and then they hang out underground. Everything, all the interesting stuff that we were focusing on, so who's mating with who, what are they doing in terms of parental care, who's fighting with whom, what are the horns do, all that stuff happens inside the tunnels underground.
Then what happens?
Then the dung only lasts for a few days until it's gone. At that point, once they've buried all that they can, the process repeats. So the males and the females will disperse, and the whole cycle repeats itself when they find another piece of dung. So they sort of alternate between being below ground and above ground.
And then do they have special adaptations, say, for smelling to be able to detect the dung, or for digging to get underground?
Yes and yes. They definitely have an exquisite sense of smell. And although I haven't worked on this, and I'm not sure that I can think of anybody who has directly worked on this, they almost certainly have had to specialize in the chemical receptors that they have on their antennae that they use for smell. I mean, if one of the main ways that these dung beetles have diversified is by specializing on different types of dung, so that there are some that'll feed on wildebeest dung, and some on zebra dung, and some on giraffe dung, and some on elephant dung. If they're specializing like that, almost certainly the characteristics that differ the most between the dung sources is the smells. And so since they use odor cues to find their food, that one of the key traits that has got to be differentiated among these different species of beetles is the particular smells that they focus in on, that they hone in on to find their food source. So although I'm guessing on this, I'd be willing to bet that there's been a ton of evolutionary specialization of their olfactory capabilities. They're all good at finding dung, but the particular types of dung that they find differ depending on the behavior and the biologies of each species.
And then is it like hairs also that are there chemical receptors, or do they have noses?
You've done your homework. Good job. So yes. So one of the kinds of chemical receptors that you find in insects generally are on the hair sensilli that they have on the outsides of their bodies. And so the hairs often have pores in them, and there are chemoreceptors inside those pores that are hooked up to neurons, so that the hairs actually are associated with smell. And so another thing that's neat about insects in general, and these beetles for sure, that's very different from ourselves and from vertebrates, is that we really smell with our noses and with our mouths. I mean, we taste and smell. Essentially, our chemoreceptors are primarily concentrated with our mouths and our noses. Insects can taste and smell all over their body. So there are insects with chemoreceptors on the leading edges of their wings that let them pick up chemicals from the air currents as they fly. Many, many insects have pads that are on their feet that are covered with these sensory hairs, so they can essentially taste and smell or whatever, respond to chemicals on everything that they land on. So a housefly that lands on the edge of your glass can taste the residues on the edge of that glass through their feet.
Really?
Yes. And they often will have these sensory hairs on the undersides of their body. They'll have them all around their mouth parts, just like we would, because that's a very logical place for them to be tasting. But the sort of primary organs of smell in insects are thought to be the antennae. And the antennae are covered with sensory hairs that all have these pores, these chemoreceptors on them. So some of the antennae that have been best studied in insects are, for example, in male moths, where they're just phenomenally sensitive to chemicals. And if I'm not mistaken, they've found that there are moth antennae that are so sensitive that they can actually detect individual molecules of the mating pheromone of that species. And I don't think that we've been able to engineer artificial sensors that come even within orders of magnitude to that level of biological sensitivity. So insect antennae are impressive. And the dung beetles, although I'm not sure they've been studied as extensively as the moths, they clearly are master organs of smell. These things really live and die by smell. They find their food by smell. They spend a lot of their lives trying to track down this food. There's so much competition for the dung that they've got to find their food sources very fast. And that means there's going to be a sort of a selective premium on individuals that are unusually good at detecting smell. And you put that onto a history of animals that for the last 40 million years or so has been specializing on all these different types of dung. And yeah, they have an incredible sense of smell.
And tell me about digging.
So this is where the turtle shape comes in, because they actually are like little bulldozers.
See, I would have thought a turtle wouldn't really make a good digger. but I guess...
Why? A turtle is a robust animal with a big, stiff shell on the outside. If you're going to be working your way down into the soil, you need some pretty tough body architecture and armor on the outside, or you're going to get torn to shreds.
So tell me how this biology helps them.
So they have very robust, thick exoskeletons. They have very strong forelegs, and the forelegs on the dung beetles have blades, these teeth. One of the diagnostics of the genus I work on, Onthophagus or Onthophagus, is that there are four teeth on the front legs of these beetles, and they look like triangular blades, and they literally carve out the clay and the soil underneath them, and they're very, very fast and efficient at it. And they also, the other thing that's interesting about these things is a bulldozer is a good analogy, because a bulldozer has this big curved blade on the front that it can push through the soil, and you don't get all that dirt clogging up the engine and tearing up the axles and everything and destroying the cab where you are in the bulldozer, because the blade protects it. Well, the dung beetles, their head is really like a bulldozer blade. And so if you look at them closely under a microscope, or if you look at the pictures that I'll send you can put online, what you'll see is that the front of these animals really is a bulldozer blade. And that's the top of the head. And you can see a little teeny bit of the eyes. There's a little slit of the eyes that pokes through on the front of that bulldozer blade. But pretty much everything else that matters is underneath. So the rest of the compound eyes are underneath, they hang underneath that bulldozer blade, underneath the shield of the front of their head. And all their mouth parts and their antennae are all things that can fold up underneath that blade. So that these things are built like bulldozers. They've got the front legs that they can carve into the soil with, and they've got this big curved flat slab of a head that's like the blade of a bulldozer that they can use to plow through the soil or to push against the walls of the tunnel, and it protects all of the delicate sensory structures of their head underneath.
Are they strong?
These things are strong.
How strong?
You can take one of these pencil-sized dung beetles, and I've done this, and I've challenged bigger, stronger men than me to do this. You can take one of these things, hold it in your hand, and squeeze your hand as tightly as you possibly can. And I guarantee you that beetle can crawl out of your hand. No matter how many pounds you can bench press, I promise you that beetle is so strong that it can force its way out of your hand. These are things that are used to digging into hard-packed clay.
So I'm picturing you challenging this beetle.
Who's stronger? It's a very humbling challenge because I always lose. But
thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the interest.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about dung beetles with Doug Emlin, a professor of biology at the University of Montana and an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre and extreme shapes in insects.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.